confided to me that the Ceruthi played tricks on all's trade envoys, hid from them, tormented them.
Tormented how?
Their worlds were eerie, disarming, uncomfortable. Something about the angles, the officer said.
The angles? He laughed sourly and shrugged.
As if something ill and twisted had infected their dimensions.
We came back empty-handed after a year.
Many of the crew quit and left the Promethean on our return, especially when Orl, who was a sick and driven man by then, declared he was going back to try again. I quit then, too, but only because I couldn't face another year below decks.
And Orl?
He went back. I presume so, anyway. A few years later, I heard his ship had been taken in the Borealis Reach by Eldar renegades. That's the sum of it. You can perhaps see why I was unwilling to tell you these things before, because there is nothing useful to tell, except to incriminate myself by admitting I had gone beyond.
I nodded. In future, do not hold information back from me.
I will not.
And if you remember anything else?
I will tell you at once.
Tobias, I paused. You say the voyage of the Promethean was long and fruitless, and the crew members were tormented by the beings they eventually encountered. Do you not have misgivings about returning there?
Of course, he smiled a thin smile. But I am bound to serve you as an agent of the Emperor, and I will do so without question. Besides, part of me is curious.
Curious?
I want to see these Ceruthi with my own eyes.
I should mention the dreams. They did not over-trouble me during the voyage, but still they lingered, every few days or so. I seldom dreamed specifically of the blank-eyed, handsome man, but he lurked obliquely in other dreams, a bystander, looking on, observing, never speaking. The lightning flashes escorted him, closer in each dream. At ship dawn of the third day of the 29th week, I rose silently and left my quarters, heading down towards the hold area where Pontius was secured. It was a good 4 hours until our daily conversation was due to start. I climbed into a service duct adjoining the hold space and crawled down until I reached a circulation grill that looked down into the hold itself. There was a frost on the grill. Below, a figure crouched by the casket, huddled in robes, lit only by a hand lamp. The overhead lights were not on. Pontius was awake. The frost told me that much, and I could see the tiny flashes of firing synapses and hear the low hiss of his voice.
Tell me of the border wars, the ones you mentioned last time. Imperial losses were great, you said.
I tell you much, and you tell me little back, replied the figure. That was not our agreement. I said I would secretly help you if you helped me. Power, Pontius. Information. If you want me to act as your emissary, I need a show of trust. How can I communicate your will to your allies if I know nothing of the true matter? A pause. What is this about? The figure asked. What is at stake? What thing of great value? Another pause.
You should go before they discover you. Eisenhorn is becoming suspicious.
Tell me, Pontius. We're nearly there. Just a few days to go. Tell me so I can help you.
I will tell you. The Necrochuk. That is what we are after, Elizabeth.
Chapter 18. KCX-1288 by the light of the Quillstar. Into the wound. The wrongness. On the first day of the 31st week, just under a day outside Maxilla's estimate, the SN burst back into real space deep inside the system designated KCX-1288. Almost at once we were in danger. The local star was a vast, swollen fireball, pulsing and retching out its last few million years of life. Distended and no longer spherical, it glowed with a malevolent pink fire beneath a cooling crust of black shreds and tatters that looked like rot infecting its granular skin. Firestorms swirled and blistered across its enlarged surface and vomited gouts of stellar matter out into the system. An immense column of excreting gas and matter plumed away from the Behemoth star, almost a light year long. It looked like a huge, luminous quill stabbed into the soft ball of that sun. From the moment of our arrival at the translation point, sirens and alarms began shrilling on the bridge. External radiation levels were almost immeasurable, and we shuddered and rocked through waves of searing star debris. The entire system was lousy with drifting radioactive banks, ash clouds, flares, and the splinters of matter they projected, and magnetic anomalies. Our shields were full on, and already we were taking damage. Maxilla said nothing, but furrowed his brow in concentration as he steered the juddering ship in through the treacherous course, negotiating the gravity pools and radioactive undertows. "It's falling apart," said Amos, awed, gazing at the main projection screen and the furiously scrolling bars of data that flickered across it. "The whole damn system is in a state of collapse." "Any sign of them?" I called to Maxilla.
"We must be right on their tail. They were half a day ahead of us, no more. Damn this interference. Wait."
"What?" He said something I couldn't hear over the cacophony. "Say again." Maxilla cancelled the screaming sirens. The juddering and shaking continued, and now we could hear the groaning and creaking of the SN's hull under stress. He pointed to the picked plate that overviewed the SN's sensor operations.
"I'm picking up their drive wake and gravitational displacement, but in these conditions it's getting really hard to read them with accuracy. There."
He tapped a glove finger on the plate.
"That's undoubtedly a drive wake. But how do you explain it?"
I shook my head. I'm no mariner.
"They've split," said Midas, looking over our shoulders. "The main portion has fallen back, maybe out of the system itself to a safe distance, and a smaller core group has continued on in. Maybe 5 ships, 6 at most."
"That's how I read it too," Maxilla agreed. "A fleet division. I'd guess they didn't want to risk sending their biggest ships into this maelstrom."
"I can see why," murmured Beckwin, gazing at the seething turmoil on the main display. "Forget about the ones that have withdrawn. Follow the lead group in," I said.
"I would advise," Maxilla began.
"Do it!"
With the aid of his navigational servitors, he adjusted the SN's trajectory and set on after the drive wake of the smaller group, driving in system.
"There, there, look,"
Maxilla called out suddenly, adjusting a secondary display unit to magnify and enhance an image. It was distant, but we could see the burst open hulk of an Imperial cruiser drifting in a halo of slowly dissipating energy.
"Definitely one of Estrom's ships. Hulled by meteor storms. They ran into trouble the moment they pressed on."
The SN shook again.
"What about us?" I asked.
Maxilla conferred with Betancourt. There was a particularly violent shudder, and the main lights went out for a second.
"We need shelter," Maxilla told me frankly.
As far as the SN's bewildered and overtaxed sensors could establish, there were 15 planets in the system, as well as millions of planetoid fragments, mostly ragged embers of wasted rock and venting energy. Our quarry's drive wake led directly to the third largest, one of the inner worlds. It was a scabby, ruined, semi-shattered ball with lingering swathes of swirling bluish atmosphere. Craters covered its northern hemisphere. Some impacts had been so large that they had torn open the mantle and exposed the livid red core beneath, like a skull cracked with devastating wounds. Even as we watched, we saw scatters of light dot and blossom across the surface as meteors struck and incinerated continents far below. We tore in through the convulsing fabric of space, past moons of blood and striated mackerel clouds of dust. A vast sheet of stellar fire swept out at us, throwing the ship wildly off course and hurling silver lumps of rock and ice against our shields.
"Madness!" cried Fischig. "They wouldn't have come here. It's death!"
Maxilla looked at me, as if hoping I'd agree with the Chastener and call us off for the sake of the SN.
"You are sure of their traces?"
Maxilla, his hands flexing on the controls, swallowed and nodded.
"Get us down there, into whatever shelter the planet's bulk can give us. At least let's confirm their corpses before we leave."
Descent took 20 minutes. None of them smooth and none of them guaranteeing a sequel. I wanted to use the time to get Loink or Maxilla's astropaths to check on the approach of the task force from Gudrun that had set out, on my instructions 30 weeks ago, to rendezvous with us here. But it was impossible. The stellar distortion rendered astrotelepathy blind. I cursed. We went in steeply, down towards the dark side of the wounded planet. Blooms of fire consumed crater-pocked landmasses in the darkness below, and ammoniacal storms raged in oceanic measures. Even here, with the planet between us and the convulsing sun, The ride was hard and rough. We saw, for a second, as we passed, another ship ruin, another of Estrom's fleet, splintered and destroyed. A death world. A death system.
"Our enemies must have made a mistake," said Amos, holding on to the edge of a console to steady himself. "The Saruthi can't be here. If they ever inhabited this system, they must have long since abandoned it."
"Yet," I countered, "the heretic fleet's advance group presses on with great determination and purpose." The SN continued to descend, closer than it would normally come to a planetary body. Only ribbons of atmosphere remained, and Maxilla clung to the ragged surface, passing barely 10 kilometers above the bare rock. Drizzles of shooting stars rained past us. "What's that?" I asked. Maxilla adjusted his senses and the resolution of the display. A huge wound in the planet's crust yawned before us, 1,000 kilometers wide, a cliff-like lip of impact-raised rock with a vast cavity beneath.
"The sensors can't resolve it. Is that meteor damage?"
"Perhaps from an angled strike," said Amos.
"Did they go past or in?" I asked.
"In?"
barked Maxilla, incredulously.
"In! Did they go in?"
Amos was leaning over the servitor at the sensor station.
"The drive wake ebbs and disappears here. Either they were vaporized en masse at this point, or they indeed went inside."
I looked at Maxilla. The SN bucked again, thrown by a gravity pool, and the bridge lights went out briefly for a second time.
"This is a star-going ship," he said softly. "Not built for surface landing."
"I know that," I replied. "But neither were theirs. They have more information than we do, and they have gone inside." Shaking his head, Maxilla turned the SN down towards the vast wound. The rift cavity was dark and limitless according to the sensors, though in my opinion the sensors were no better than useless now. A dull red glow suffused the darkness far below us. The violent shaking had stopped, but still the hull creaked and protested at the gravitational stress. We had the sudden impression of moving through some structure, then another, then a third. The display revealed the fourth before we passed under it, an angular hoop or arch 80 kilometers across. Beyond it, more in the series, towering around us as we progressed, as if we were passing down the middle of a giant ribcage.
"They're octagonal," said Amos.
"And irregular," I added. No two of the rib arches were the same, but they displayed the same form and lack of symmetry as their companions, the shape we now instantly associated with the Saruthi.
"These can't be natural," said Maxilla.
We continued in under the cyclopean spans, passing through a dozen, then a dozen more. "Light sources ahead," a servitor announced. A dull greenish glow fogged into being far away down the avenue of octagonal arches.
"Do we continue?"
asked Maxilla. I nodded. "Send a marker drone back to the surface." A moment later, the rear display showed a small servitor drone struggling back up the vast channel towards the surface, running lights winking. We ran on past the last arch. There was another judder. Then we were riding clear into light, smooth, pale green light. There seemed to be no roof or ceiling to whatever we were in, though inside the planetary cavity we undoubtedly were. Just hazy green light, and below, a carpet of wispy cloud. All turbulence stopped. We were like a ship becalmed. The atmosphere in this place, logic battled to make us remember we were inside the crust of a planet, was thin and inert, a vaguely ammoniacal vapor. None of us could explain the source of the pervasive luminescence or the fact that the SN sat comfortably at grav anchor in the serene quiet. As Maxilla had pointed out, it was not a trans-atmospheric vessel, and it should have been impossible to stabilize it this close to a planetary body without severe stress damage. From its system registers, the SN seemed happy enough, happy to have ridden out the vile stellar storms of KCX-1288 into this safe harbor. Apart from minor impact damage, only two of the ship's systems were inoperative. The sensors were blind and giving back nothing but odd, dead echoes. And every chronometer on the ship had stopped, except two that were running backwards. Betancourt and Maxilla studied the imperfect returns of the sensor arrays and concluded land of some sort lay beneath us, under the cloud bank. We estimated that it was 6 kilometers straight down, though in this vague, hazy rift it was difficult to say. If Glor's heretics were here, they had left no trace. But with our senses so badly occluded, their advance fleet could be anchored just on the other side of the clouds. We dropped to the cloud bank from the SN in the gun cutter shortly afterwards. All of us had buckled on hard armor vacuum suits from Maxilla's lockers. Loink, Fischig, Amos and I shambled about the crew bay, getting used to the heavy plate and bulky quilting of the suits. Beckwin was in the cockpit with Betancourt, watching him take us down. The pair of them wore borrowed vacuum suits too, and she was pinning up her hair so it would not interfere with the helmet seal.
"Good hunting, Inquisitor," crackled Maxilla from the SN above us.
"He'll be down there, won't he?" asked Beckwin,
and I knew she was referring to Mandragore. "It's likely. Him, and whatever this is all about."
"Well, you heard what Pontius said," she replied.
How could I not have? The Necrochuke. One doesn't hear a word like that and forget it. It had taken her weeks to gain the confidence of our bodiless prisoner, to play the part of a disaffected traitor. I hadn't been sure she was up to it, but she had performed with patience and a finely gauged measure of play-acting. It had been a risk, letting her slip in to see Pontius alone. She had assured me she could do it, and she had not been wrong. The Necrochuke. If Pontius Glor was telling the truth, our enterprise had even greater urgency now. I had wondered what could be so precious, so important, as to galvanize our enemies so, make them risk so much. I had my answer. Legend said the last extant copy of that abominable work had been destroyed millennia before. Except that by some means, in antique ages past, a copy had come into the hands of the Zaruthi race. And now they were preparing to trade it back to Glor's imperial heretics. We came down through the clouds and saw the land below, a wide, rolling expanse of dust sweeping down to what seemed to be a sea. Liquid frothed and broke along a curved shoreline 100 kilometers long. Everything was a shade of pale green, bathed by the radiance that glowed through the wispy clouds. There was a misty softness to it all, a lack of sharp focus. It seemed endless, toneless, slow. There was a calm, ethereal feel that was at once soothing and unnerving. Even the lapping sea seemed languid. It reminded me of the seacoast at Tralito, on Kalan II, where I had spent a summer recuperating from injuries years before. Endless leagues of mica dunes, the slow sea, the balmy, hazy air.
"How big?" I asked Midas.
"Is what?"
he asked.
"This place."
He pointed to the instruments.
"Can't say. 100 kilometers? 2? 3? 1,000?
"You must have something."
He looked round at me with a smile that had worry in it.
"Systems say it's endless. Which is, of course, impossible. So I think the instruments are out. I'm not trusting them anyway."
"Then what are you flying by?"
"My eye, or the seat of my pants. Whichever you find most reassuring."
We followed the slow curve of the endless bay for about 10 minutes. At last, details emerged to break up the uniform anonymity. A row of arches, octagonal, jutting from the sand a few 100 meters back from the waterline, ran parallel to the water. They were each about 50 meters broad, in everything but scale, the twins of the arches Maxilla had guided the SN through. They extended away as far as we could see in the green haze.
"Set us down."
We sat the gun cutter on the soft, dusty sand, 0.5 kilometer from the shore, clamped on our helmets and ventured out. The radiance was greater than I had expected. The cutter's ports had been tinted, and we slid down brown glass overvisors against the glare. I hate vacuum suits. The sense of being muffled and constrained, the ponderous movement, the sound of my own breath in my ears, the sporadic click of the intercom. The suit shut out all sounds from outside, except the crunch of my feet on the fine, dry sand. We shuffled down to the water's edge in a wide file. All of us, except Amos, carried weapons. It looked like a sea. Green water showing white at the breakers.
"Liquid ammonia," Amos said,
his voice a low crackle over the vox. There was something strange about it.
"Do you see it?"
he asked me.
"What?"
"The waves are moving out from the shore."
I looked again. It was so obvious I had missed it. The liquid wasn't rushing in and breaking. It was sucking away from the shore and rolling back into itself. It was chilling. So simple. So wrong. My confidence withered. I wanted to strip off the claustrophobic suit and cry out. And I would have, except for the stark red warning lights and the atmosphere reader built into my suit's bulky left cuff. What was it Maxilla had said? The Ceruthi had tormented the men of the Promethean. I didn't know for a moment if the unnatural behavior of the sea was their doing. How could it have been? But I understood how insidious, distressing torment might have played upon them. Fischig and Betancourt had approached the first of the arches. I looked across and saw them dwarfed by the unsymmetrical structure. The next in the line was 300 meters away, and they seemed regularly spaced. Each one, as far as I could see, was irregular in a different way, though the size and proportions were identical. Beckwin was kneeling on the shoreline, brushing the sand aside gently with her gauntlet. She had found what was perhaps the most distressing detail so far. Under the sand, a few centimeters down, the ground was tiled. Tessellated, irregular octagonal tiles, just like the ones she had found on the floor of the mine working at North Quam. Once more, they fitted perfectly, impossibly, despite their shape. The more of them she uncovered, the more she brushed the sand away. "Stop it," I said. "For our sanity, I don't think it's worth trying to discover if they cover the entire beach."
"Can all of this be artificial?" she asked.
"It can't be," said Amos. "Perhaps the tiles and the arches are part of some old structure, long abandoned, that has since been flooded and covered with the dust, due to... He didn't sound at all convincing. I crossed to Fischig and Betancourt and stood with them, gazing up at the first arch. It was wrought from that odd, unknown metal we had seen on Damask.
"What do we do now?"
Fischig asked.
"Well, I hate to state the obvious," said Amos from down the beach, "but the last row of these we found formed a deliberate pathway that led the SN in here. Should we assume this serves the same purpose?"
I stepped forward through the broad, towering shape of the first arch. "Come on," I said. We walked for what I estimated was perhaps 20 minutes. Estimated. All of our chronometers were dead. After the first few minutes, we began to hear a distant, repetitive boom. A low, almost subsonic peal like thunder that rolled out from somewhere far away over the sea. Or seemed to. It came every half minute or so. There were long intervals of silence, and just when we'd thought we'd heard the last, another boom would come. Like the crunch of our own footsteps, we could hear it through the suits, even with our vox circuits switched off. I voxed to Maxilla. "Can you hear that?" There was a crackle and no immediate reply. Then a sudden burst of transmission. Maxilla's voice.
"As you instruct, Gregor, but it's not going to be easy. Say again. What did you say about Fischig?"
"Maxilla, repeat," I began. But his voice continued over the top, incoherent. It wasn't a reply. I was just picking up his voice. I felt my spine go cold. More static.
"Tell Elizabeth I agree with that. Ha!"
It went dead. I looked back at the others. Their pale faces gazed out of the tinted brown faceplates like ghosts. "What was that?" I murmured.
"An echo," Amos whispered. "Some kind of transmission anomaly caused by the atmosphere and the..."
"It's not a conversation I've ever had." Another boom of thunder rolled across the dry, softly lit shore. After my estimated 20 minutes, we passed through what was suddenly the last arch. We all stopped. Ahead of us, the land rose more steeply, into hills and low ridges. The terrain there was darker, inhospitable. The overall radiance had dulled, and the sky was a deep green, oozing into blackness over the hills.
There were more in the row," Fischig exclaimed. "More arches!"
He was right. The octagonal colonnade had disappeared as we passed through the last arch. I stepped back through, imagining perhaps that from the other side the arches might reappear. They didn't. The booming continued. We set off towards the hills. Bursts of static hissed through our vox units.
"Transmissions,"
said Loink. He fiddled with his vox channels.
"I can't tune them in, but their chatter. Military. Back and forth."
"Our quarry, perhaps."
"Look,"
said Betancourt, pointing behind us. Beyond the shore and the retreating line of archers, three ominous dark shapes hung under the clouds, out over the sea. Two Imperial frigates and an old, non-standard merchantman, floating at grav anchor.
How did we not see them when we passed?
I don't know, Midas. I'm not sure of anything anymore. When I turned back to the rest of the group, I saw Amos unclasping his helmet. Amos!
Calm yourself, he said, uncovering his wizened old head.
With the wide locking collar of the suit around him, he looked like a tortoise, pushing its gnarled head from its shell. He raised his left arm and showed me the atmosphere reader. The lights were green.
Human perfect atmosphere, he said. A little cold and sterile, but human perfect.
We all unclasped our helmets and pulled them off. The chilly air bit my face, but it was good to be free of the suits. There was no scent to the air, none at all. Not salt or ammonia or dust. We helped each other fasten our helmets to our shoulder packs. The booming was duller and more distant now. It didn't have our hollow helmets to resonate through. We could hear each other's footsteps, each other's breathing, the suck and lap of the ocean. I could suddenly smell Beckwin's perfume. It was reassuring. I led the group on, and we climbed slowly into the rising land. Now free of the helmet, I understood our ponderous progress was a result of more than our heavy suits. It was somehow difficult to gauge distance and depth. We stumbled every now and then. The whole place was profoundly wrong. We came upon them very suddenly. The sudden resumption of the Vox traffic was our only warning. Our speakers burst into life simultaneously.
Run! Move up! Segment two! Where are you? Where are you?
Cover to the left! That's an order! Cover to the left!
They're behind me! They're behind me and I
A fierce hiss of static. Ahead, coming down the ridges and slopes of the dark rise, we saw soldiers, Imperial Guard, wearing red and gold combat armor. Gudrunite riflemen.
Cover!
I ordered, and we dropped down into the shelter of the rising dunes, readying weapons. There were 60 or more of them, hurrying down the upper slopes towards us in a wide straggle, running. There was no order to it. They were fleeing. An officer in their midst was waving his arms and shouting, but they were ignoring him. Many had lost helmets or rifles. A second later, their pursuers came over the rise and fell upon them from behind. Three black armored speeders in the livery of Navy security and a following line of 30 troopers in their distinctive black armor, ordered, disciplined, marching in a spaced line, firing their hell guns into the backs of the fleeing conscripts. The land speeders swept in low, drizzling the slopes with cannon fire. The shots threw up plumes of dust and the mangled bodies of men. A second later, and all three land speeders passed over us at what seemed like head height, overshooting across the ammonia sea and banking round to follow in on another pass. Some of the Gudrunites were firing back, and I saw one trooper topple and fall, but there was no coordination, no control.
"What the hell? Do we stay hidden?"
gasped Beckwin.
"They'll see us soon enough," said Fischig,
sliding open the feed slit of his heavy Stubbers box magazine. The odds were terrible, and ever since the incident on the SN, I'd had a morbid loathing of the black-clad troopers. But still, I pulled out my heavy auto-pistol and tossed it to Amos, freeing my las carbine from the fastener lugs on my pack. Beckwin drew her own weapons, a pair of las pistols. Loink and Midas had their firearms, a las carbine and a Glavian needle rifle, respectively, already braced in their hands.
"Look to the troops," I told Fischig, Loink, and Beckwin. "Do what you can, Amos. Midas, the flyers are down to us."
We bellied forward through the dunes, and then came up firing. Fischig's big gun smashed into the lip of the high ridge, kicking up dust, before he found range and demolished three of the stalking troopers. Loink's carbine cracked out, and Amos fired the auto-pistol hesitantly. Beckwin was amazing. She'd used her time well during the 30-week passage, and Midas had clearly instructed her carefully. A las pistol in each hand, she whooped out a battle cry of sorts and placed careful shots that dropped two more of the troopers. The troopers balked in their ruthless advance, realizing the situation had suddenly changed. The scattering Gudrunites also wavered, and some of them, the officer included, turned and began to confront the killers. I had been counting on this. We couldn't take them alone. I had trusted that our sudden intervention might galvanize the guardsmen. Still, many ran. A fierce firefight erupted along the ridge between the halted troopers and those Gudrunites below who were turning to fight. Loink, Fischig, Amos, and Beckwin moved forward in support. The landspeeders swept back, hammering the shore with shells. Betancourt dropped to one knee, raised his exotic weapon, and fired. The long barrel pulsed and made a sound like a whispered shriek. Explosive splinters tore through the nearest speeder as it crossed down over us, and it blew apart in the air. Burning wreckage scattered across the sand. I chased a second with my carbine. It was turning to present on us, and the turn made it slow. My shots missed or deflected from the armor. As its heavy cannon began to fire, pulverizing the sand in a stitching row towards me, I shot the pilot through the faceplate. Still firing, it plunged suddenly and hit the beach 50 meters behind me. It bounced, shredding apart, struck again and crashed into the breakers in a spray of debris that threw up thousands of mismatched splashes. The third speeder turned in and made another pass, killing 6 more of the fleeing Gudrunites, who presented easy targets on the sand. Midas had his weapon trained on it and fired as it passed over, missing. He fired again, striking its rear end as it burned away. It kept going, over the beach, out to sea. I have no idea what he hit, the crew, the control systems, but it just kept going, on and on, until it disappeared from sight. We pressed up the slope, in among the Gudrunites now. They were dirty and disheveled to a man, none older than 25. Seeing us and the damage we had wrought, they cheered, perhaps imagining we were part of some greater rescue force. On the upper ridge, the last few troopers were crumpling. Fischig charged them, his stubber wailing, and a dozen Gudrunites went with him, eager to turn on their tormentors. The ridge fight lasted another 2 minutes. Fischig lost 2 of the Gudrunites with him, but made certain none of the troopers survived. Law enforcement, I remember thinking, had robbed the military of a fine soldier in Chasener Fischig. I sought out the Gudrunite officer as his men collapsed, weary with exhaustion and relief. Some were weeping. All of them looked scared. Smoke from the battle drifted down the ridge in the windless air. The officer, a sergeant, was no older than his men. He had attempted to grow a beard, but his facial hair wasn't really up to it. He saluted me even before I had shown him my badge of office. Then he fell on his knees. "Get up," he did. "Inquisitor Eisenhorn. And you are?"
"Sergeant Eniel Jerus, 2nd Battalion, 50th Gudrunite Rifles. Sir, is the fleet here?"
I held out my hand to quieten him down. "Appraise me, quickly and briefly."
"We wanted no part of it. We were mustered to the frigate Exalted, waiting to ship out. When we ran from Gudrun High Anchor, the captain told us all Gudrun had fallen and we were relocating."
"The captain?"
"Captain Estrom, sir."
"And then?"
30 weeks in transit to get here. The moment we arrived, we knew something was wrong. We protested, demanded to know what was happening. They called it dereliction and sent dozens to the firing squads. We were given a chance to follow orders or die."
"Not much of a chance." He shook his head.
"No, sir. That's why I tried to get the men out. We broke and ran, once we'd got in there, once they were busy. They came after us to hunt us down."
"In where?" He gestured back over the ridge.
"The darkness."
"Tell me what you saw," I said. Chapter 19. Yeros makes his report. At the plateau. The true matter.
"I don't even know what world we're on," Sergeant Yeros said. "They never told us. The ride in was rough, though."
"It has no name, as far as I know. Go on."
"They deployed us from the ships along this beach as an escort detail for the main party."
"How many men?"
"Over 100 naval security troopers, and 300 or so of us guard."
"Vehicles?"
"Speeders, like you saw, and a pair of heavier personnel carriers for some crates of cargo and the main party."
"What do you know of them?" Yeros shrugged.
"Of the cargo, nothing. In the main party was the captain, and Lord Glor of Gudrun. He's a worthy nobleman from my homeworld."
"I know him. Who else?"
"Some others, too. A merchant. An ecclesiarch, and a great and terrible warrior that they tried to keep away from us, regular troops."
"Mandragore, no doubt. And Datso and Locke. The core of Oberon Glor's cabal." "Then what?"
Yeros pointed up the slopes in the dark, forbidding uplands. "We advanced into that. It seemed to me they knew where they were going. Things changed as we went further in. It got darker and warmer, and it was hard to negotiate the way as if..."
"As if what?"
"We couldn't judge distances. Sometimes it was like wading through hot wax. Sometimes we could barely slow ourselves down. Some of the men panicked. We found polygons, like these on the beach."
It was his word for the hoop-like arches. There were rows of them, aisles, marching away into the uplands. They were so irregular they disturbed the mind. They seemed to vary, to change.
What do you mean, irregular?
I went to no officer school, sir, but I am educated. I understand simple geometry. The angles of the polygons did not add up, yet they were there.
Chilled, I recalled Maxilla's mention of the unwholesome angles, and thought too of the marking on the tile I had taken from Damask.
We followed some of these rows, passing through polygons on occasions. The ecclesiarch and the merchant seemed to be leading us. And there was another man, a tech priest type.
Slim build. Blue eyes.
Yes.
His name is Malahite. He played a part in choosing your path.
Yes, they deferred to him on several occasions. Finally, we came to a plateau, a great raised, wide space, overlooked by jagged peaks of rock. The plateau was artificial, tiled with smooth stones that...
He tried to make a shape with his index fingers and thumbs, but shrugged and gave up. More impossible polygons. He laughed nervously.
Yes, the plateau was vast. We waited there, the men grouped around the outside of the space, the main party and the vehicles in the centre.
And then?
We waited what seemed like hours, but it was impossible to tell because our chronometers had all stopped. Then there was some kind of dispute. Lord Glore was arguing with some of the others. I saw this as a chance. I got the men ready. Nearly 90 of us, ready and eager to trust to chance and flee. All eyes were on the shouting match. The big warrior, God Emperor, save me. He was shouting by then. I think the sound of his voice was what decided us. We slipped away in twos and threes, from the back of the ranks, down the sides of the plateau, and ran back the way we'd come.
And they discovered your escape?
Eventually, and came hunting for us. The rest you know.
I waited a few moments for him to collect himself, and gathered the men around. There were about 30 riflemen left, all of them scared, and another 3 or 4 wounded. Amos did what he could for them. I rose and addressed them all. In defying your officers and leaders, you have served the Emperor. The men who brought you here are imperial heretics, and their enterprise is criminal. My purpose here is to stop them. I intend to press on at once on that mission. I cannot vouch for the safety of any who follow me, but I count it as a mark of honour to the Emperor himself that you will. He needs our service here, now. If you take seriously the oaths you made to the Imperium when you became guardsmen, then you will not hesitate. There is no more vital battle in which you might give your lives. Wild, frightened faces stared back at me. There was a murmur of agreement, but these were young, inexperienced men, some no more than boys, who had been thrown into the deep waters of madness. Steel yourselves, and know that the Emperor is with you and for you in this. I don't exaggerate when I say the future rests in our hands. More voluble assent now. These men weren't cowards. They just needed a purpose and a sense that they were fighting for a worthy cause. I whispered briefly to Fischig, and he immediately stepped up and raised his voice to the Imperial Creed and the Song of Allegiance, hymns that every child in the Imperium knew. The Gudrunites joined in lustily. It centred and focused their determination. Still, the booming came along the shore. With Betancourt's help, I stripped arms and equipment from the fallen. There were enough weapons to make sure every man had a las rifle or a hell gun. We also managed to assemble 3 intact naval trooper uniforms, mixing and matching from the dead. I stripped off my bulky vacuum suit and began to put on the polished black combat armor of a naval security trooper. Midas attempted to do the same, but his build was too slim for the heavy rig. The troopers were, to a man, large brutes. We dressed Fischig in the armor instead, and then, so as not to waste the third set, chose a heavyset Gudrunite from Yeris's group, a corporal named Twain. "What's the Gudrunite command channel?" I asked Yeris as I adjusted the helmet voxet.
"Beta, Phi, Beta."
"And of the men you left in there at the plateau, how many others might side with us?"
"All the Gudrunites, I would say. Sergeant Credin's unit, certainly."
"Your job will be to rally them to us when we get inside. I'll give the word." He nodded. We left the wounded on the shore, as comfortable as we could make them, and advanced into the dark uplands. As Yeris had told me, it quickly became darker and warmer. The sleek black body armor I was now wearing had an integral cooling system, but it didn't seem to help.
and the wrongness still afflicted us. It was difficult to walk without stumbling in places. We came upon the first of the arches, and Yeres led us through, though we would have been able to follow the course without difficulty. Footsteps and the tracks of heavy vehicles had left deep prints and ruts in the soft, dusty soil. We were advancing up a cluster of hills, dark and uninviting, with a glowering sky above. There were many rows of arches, some overlapping. We became disoriented. It seemed on occasions that as we passed through one arch, we came out through another in a different row. The tracks never wavered or broke, but we seemed to blink between one aisle of hoops and another. And the angles of the joints in the arches were, as Yeres had said, geometrically incorrect. "I think," Amos said quietly to me as we walked onwards, "the lack of symmetry is in every particular and every dimension."
"Meaning?"
"The three we can see, and the fourth, time. Dimensions have been stretched and warped, perhaps accidentally, perhaps to torment us, perhaps for some other purpose. But I think that is why things are so twisted and wrong."
We came at last upon the place Yeres had called the Plateau. It was a flat-topped mound, nearly a kilometre across, smoothly tiled with octagonal tesserae that mocked logic. The sides sloped down to the dusty soil all around. The site was ringed by ragged brown peaks and crags. Above, the sky was dark and flecked with stars. On our side of the plateau, a semicircle of several hundred men sat huddled around the rim, waiting. I could feel their tension. More than half of them were Gudrunites. The others were troopers. Smaller groups of soldiers stood in ordered ranks further towards the centre of the plateau, escorting two navy troop carriers in which figures sat, and a pair of empty land speeders. A pile of crates had been removed from the carriers and piled on the tiled ground. On the far side of the plateau, a row of arches led away into the surrounding rocks. We lay in cover and waited, watching. After an interminable period, there was movement on the far side, and figures emerged from the arches. Even at a distance, I could tell they were Datso and Malahite, with four naval troopers in escort. They came out briskly, signalling to the main group at the vehicles. All the troops around the rim got to their feet. Other shapes now appeared through the arches. They were impossible to define at first, grey, reflective shapes that had no human form or intelligible movement. I took out my scope and trained it on them, carefully resolving the magnification, and I saw the Ceruthi for the first time. There were nine of them, as far as I could tell. They made me think of arachnids or crustaceans, but neither comparison was entirely accurate. From their flat grey bodies extended five supporting limbs, jointed in such a way so that the main mid-limb joint was raised higher than the horizontal torso. There was no symmetry to the arrangement of limbs, or to the way in which they moved. Their scuttling pace was irregular and without repetition of order. It was disturbing merely to watch them walk. Each limb ended in a caliper of polished silver, a metal stilt clasped in the digits of each limb, lifting them a further metre or so off the ground. The metal spikes of the stilts made a clacking, tapping sound on the hard tiles that I could hear despite the distance. Their heads were oblate shapes rising on thick, boneless columns from the tops of their bodies. They had long skulls and lacked obvious mouths or eyes, though several flaring, nostril-like openings showed on their snouts. There was no symmetry to the arrangement of these openings either, nor to the shape of the skulls, and their necks sprouted off-center from their backs. They were loathsome, filthy things. Each creature was twice the mass of a man, with gleaming grey flesh. Shouts and noises of alarm came from some of the waiting men. Several turned and fled from the plateau, scrabbling, wailing. The nine Ceruthi clicked their way out into the open from the hoop, fanning out until they formed a semicircular line facing Datso and Malahite. I saw Oberon Glor, Gorgon Locke, Estrum, and the monstrous form of Mandragore descend from the vehicles to join their comrades. I confess that I was by then as afraid as those with me. I have seen horror, and horror itself does not terrify me. Nor indeed was there anything horrific about these beings. Alien, yes, and as a Puritan that was alarming, but objectively they were impressive, striking creatures, assured, almost majestic. My fear stemmed from a deeper gut instinct. As with this world we had entered, there was a wrongness to them, to their shape, their movement, their design. Each scuttling limb, each swaying head betrayed an unholy nature. I could not have believed how reassuring symmetry could be, and how distressing might be its lack. They were warped things, warped from any civilized sense of grace, any human understanding of aesthetics. Their bodies and limbs were so irregular they didn't even seem to make sense, as if, like the tiles and the arches, their angles didn't add up correctly. Fear, then, swayed me. I looked around at my companions and saw fear on their gazing faces, too. Fear, revulsion, disbelief. Amos saved my life and sanity. He and he alone stared in wonder at the Ceruthi, a perplexed smile of intellectual delight on his ancient face.
"Most perturbatory," I heard him murmur.
That simple detail made me laugh. My confidence returned, and with it my resolve. I waved Fishig and the soldier Twain over to me, and then made certain that Beckwin, Midas, and Yerus were sufficiently in control of their faculties to be left in charge. Yerus and Twain needed some fierce cajoling. Beckwin was already prepared, her weapons drawn. The sight of Mandragore had fired her will. "Wait for my signal," I told Midas. To Fishig I said, "Keep an eye on our friend here," meaning Twain. The three of us crept down from cover and approached the edge of the plateau. The men were all on their feet, murmuring, alarmed, looking at the meeting taking place at the center of the platform. Naval security officers scolded the Gudrunites and kept them in line, but I could tell they were uneasy too. We came up the slope and melted into the watching crowd. Gudrunites got out of our way, three more naval oppressors with blank visors and low-strapped hell guns. We came almost to the front of the crowd. A trooper near me growled, "I didn't sign up for this," as he stared at the Ceruthi, 200 meters away. "Pull yourself together," I snapped to him, and he looked at me sharply. "It isn't right," he murmured. "We'll see, won't we?" I said, patting my hell gun. "If Estrom and these others have led us into a nightmare, they'll see how Scarus Fleet's troopers account for themselves." He nodded and readied his own weapon. Twain, Fishig, and I moved forward again. No one paid us any heed. Indeed, many troopers were moving forward to flank the vehicles now. I looked again at the meeting. Oberon Glor, his long robes spilling down from upraised arms, was greeting the Ceruthi with words I couldn't hear. It went on a while. Finally, he half-turned and gestured towards the waiting crates. His voice reached me. "And in good faith, we have brought the properties as agreed." Locke moved back from the group. "Attend me," he ordered to the naval troopers around him. I moved forward at once, and so did Fishig. In a second, we were part of a team of more than a dozen troopers carrying the first of the crates forward. I was right next to Locke, my black-gloved hands clutching the carrying handle next to his brawny fists. We set the crates down in front of the Ceruthi and withdrew a few paces. Locke remained and opened a crate lid as one of the Ceruthi clattered forward. I saw them now, close to. It was no better. Their grey skin was covered with whirled pores, and the nostrils on their snouts flared and clenched. I could see that each of their limbs ended in what looked abominably like a human hand, grey-skinned, gripping the crossbar of each silver stilt. The Ceruthi that had moved forward set two of his stilts down on the tiles and reached into the open crate with flickering fingers. It searched by touch for a moment, and then withdrew its hands empty. Its eyeless skull swayed slightly on its neck. Then it raised those free hands high, clasped together, as a man might raise his hands over his head in victory. The long, rubber-jointed fingers of each hand, and I cannot say for sure how many digits each hand had, or even if they each had the same number, twisted and clenched around each other, and formed a shape, a visage, a human face. Eyes, a nose, a wide mouth, perfect, impossible, chilling. The raised effigy of a face seemed to study us. Then the mouth moved. "Your bond you have with truth made, being man." There was a hush of alarm in the crowd at my back. The voice was dull and tuneless, without inflection, but the finger mouth puppeted the speech with awful precision.
"Then we may trade," Glor stammered.
The hands parted, and the face vanished. The creature took up its stilts again and scuttled backwards. Its kin also moved back, away from the arch. More creatures emerged, more Ceruthi, identical to those who had already appeared, flanking other things. There seemed to be four of them, with body structures similar to the aliens, but they were bloated and misshapen. Their rugose flesh was white and sickly, and blotched with marks that seemed like disease. Instead of stilts, their limbs were fitted with heavy metal hooves, linked all around by wires that acted like shackles. These pallid, wretched things, slaves of the Zaruthi, I had no doubt, moaned as they moved, filling the air with a sickly whining. The waiting Zaruthi jabbed at them with the points of their stilts as they clattered past onto the plateau. Between them, on their backs, the four slave things carried a trapezoidal casket of black metal, covered with irregularly spaced wart-like protuberances. They came to a halt and sank down onto their bellies. Datso and Malahite moved forward, approaching the casket-bearers. A stilted Zaruthi scuttled around beside them, reached a long limb over to extend his silver caliper, and pressed the point against one of the protuberances. The casket opened on invisible hinges, like the petals of a malformed flower. I think I had expected light to radiate out, or some other show of power. There was none. Malahite stepped forward between the kneeling limbs of the slave things and reached out, but Datso pushed him back with a curse and a slap of psychic power that sent him sprawling. A ripple of response ran through the Zaruthi, making them scuttle on the spot. Now Datso reached into the casket. He took out a tiny oblong, no bigger than a bolt gun's magazine, and held it in trembling hands, gazing at it. A book. Ancient parchment encased in a sleeve of black Zaruthi metal, closed with a clasp.
"Well, Ecclesiarch," Glore growled, "we need confirmation."
Datso unclasped the cover and turned the first antique page.
"The true matter is ours,"
he stammered, and fell to his knees. The Necrochuk. They had the Necrochuk. It was now or never, I thought. Chapter 20. My ally, Confusion. The Wrath of Mandragore. Against Oberon. I bellowed, "Look out! They're attacking!" and slammed myself hard into the two troopers by my side. As we went over in a clumsy thrashing heap, I fired my hellgun wildly for good measure. Tension among the humans gathered around the plateau was intense. The Zaruthi, I firmly believe, had deliberately used their devices and environment to foment that tension, perhaps intending to weaken and cow the humans they found themselves dealing with. If so, they had done too good a job. Gudrunites and troopers alike were at snapping point, their minds and spirits rattled by their location and by what they had seen. A warning voice and a few shots was all it took to spill the tension over. All around me, men yelled out and weapons crackled. Assuming an attack on their high-born leaders, the troopers, still firmly loyal to Glore and Estrom, surged forward, firing on the Zaruthi with their assault guns. Others wavered in confusion and lashed out at those around them. The Gudrunites around the rim of the plateau turned their guns on their oppressors, or fired at the vehicles. From the rim of the plateau, Midas and Bequin led our rearguard in a charge, weapons blazing. In a second, the air was full of shouts and screams, gunfire and skittering lasbolts. Total confusion reigned. I could hear Yaruso, the guard vox channel, rallying his comrades, calling for them to turn on the Navy personnel. The Naval Security Combat Channel was riven with orders and countermands, squeals of rage and bellowed curses. I heard Oberon Glore screaming for order and the baying howl of Mandragore behind it all. "Fishig, Twain, sow confusion, make for the target!" Disguised, like me, the pair moved forward. The mayhem was too dense and frenzied for there to be any sense of opposing sides. Guards fought naval troopers, or even each other, and indiscriminate fire whipped in all directions. I shot down a trooper who ran past me, and another nearby who turned in dismay. Past them I saw the tall, spare form of the rogue Captain Estrom gazing at me through the smoke wash with incredulity. His eyes bulged more than ever.
"What the hell are you doing, trooper?"
he managed to bark, his pronounced Adam's apple bobbing furiously. "Performing the ministry of the Sacred Inquisition," I told him, and shot him through the head. The Zaruthi had been thrown into a state of great agitation. I have no way of knowing what emotions they were experiencing, if they experienced any at all. But they reacted as if horrified by the turn of events, distressed and appalled. Hellgun fire from troopers who were convinced that the aliens were the aggressors blasted into two of them. One burst open and collapsed on the tiles in a spreading pool of grey ichor and gristle. The other lost a limb and began to drag itself towards the arches with its remaining stilts. Over the tumult of gunfire and human voices, the Zaruthi began to wail. Whether it was a threat,
a warning, a call of distress, or an order to retreat, I could not tell. They scuttled maniacally, their alien shriek shaking the air. Two clattered forward suddenly, towards the bewildered trooper escort. Electric blue discharges fizzled around the Saruthi's swaying heads, and then spat raking beams of ice-bright energy at their attackers. Two troopers were vaporized, their constituent matter boiling away in searing flashes of light. I caught sight of Mandragor. The brute had already killed one trooper in an attempt to curtail the mindless wildfire, but now the Saruthi had fired on them, the troopers clearly felt justified in their action and redoubled their efforts. An alien beam sliced into Mandragore's arm, and rage consumed him. He attacked the Saruthi himself, wielding a massive chain axe. I hoped they'd kill him. I pushed through a jumble of bodies and came out on the other side of the parked vehicles. Ahead, I saw Datso, still kneeling by the ghastly white slave beasts as if in a trance. The unholy prize was clenched in his hands. I ran at him. Fischig, his helmet missing, appeared alongside me. His borrowed black armor was awash with blood. "Twain!" he bawled over his shoulder, and the disguised Gudrunite appeared, running after us, firing from the hip. Grenades were now exploding amid the mindless fighting. Bodies and chips of octagonal tiling were hurled into the air. One of the troop carriers was on fire. The three of us were closest by far to the accursed true matter. A Saruthi came ploughing forward, spurring the jostling, frenzied slave things aside with its stilt spikes as it made for Datso. With a juddering blow from one stilt, it knocked the kneeling man over and sent the Necrochuk scattering from his hands. Malahite, on his hands and knees by the slave things, let out a cry and dived after it. The Saruthi jittered around to stop him, just as Fischig and Twain blew it apart with hellgun shots. Stringy grey fluid splashed across the tessellated tiles. Another Saruthi, its skull crackling with electrical power, blasted its kin's murderers. Twain convulsed and exploded in a drizzle of matter. By his side, Fischig was thrown over by the blinding detonation, his armor ripped open. There was no time to help him. Clutching the book, Malahite was running away across the plateau, away from the straggled, brutal warfare. I severed his left leg at the knee with a round from my hellgun, and he dropped onto his face. When I reached him, he was clawing forward, daubed in blood, reaching for the fallen book. "Leave it!" I snapped, pulling off my helmet and pointing the hellgun down at him, one-handed. He saw my face and cursed. I knelt and picked up the little volume. Even through my armored gloves, I could feel its heat. For a second, a long, hypnotized second, it was all I knew. I understood why Datso had remained kneeling there for so long after he first grasped it. The content of the book, that ancient lore, was alive somehow, fidgeting, rustling, calling to me, calling me by name. It knew me. It beckoned to me, telling me to open it and experience its wonders. I didn't even think to resist. What it was showing me was so wondrous, so sublime, so beautiful. The stars themselves, and behind the stars the mechanisms of reality, the intricate and oh-so-perfect workings of a transcendent natural force we misguidedly and dismissively called chaos. I undid the wire-like clasps that kept the book shut. Abruptly, a rough, foul psychic force burst into my mind, breaking the spell. I began to turn to look away from the opening book. That half-turn was just enough to stop me dying. I was felled by a monumental blow to the shoulder. As I dropped, the book spun helplessly from my yearning hand. The tiles underneath me were awash with blood. My blood. I rolled over as the next blow came. The screaming teeth of the chain axe missed me by a hair's breadth and shattered the bloody tiles. Mandragore, bastard child of the Emperor. I scrambled backwards in blind panic. The stinking chaos warrior was right on me, his lurid armor flecked with human blood and alien ichor. My dazed half-turn at the last moment had spoiled his first blow, but still the backplate of my naval trooper combat armor was shredded. The left shoulder guard was completely ripped away. The glancing shoulder wound was savage and deep. Blood gouted through torn flesh and armor, cascading down my left arm. Writhing backwards, I found my hands slipping on the blood-washed octagons. I lashed out with my mind. It was no match for his fearsome psychic capacity, but it was enough to put him off his swing. The shrieking chain blade of the axe soared through the air over my ducking head. My fallen hellgun was out of reach, and I doubted it would have made a dent in the monster anyway. His baying face, its suited-on skin stretching around the gaping jaws of his skull, was all I could see. My left arm was numb and useless, I threw myself to my feet, pulling my sword from my webbing. The device is a fine weapon, of the old kind. It has no material blade like other cruder models I have seen. It is a hilt, 20 centimeters long, inlaid and wound with silver thread, enclosing a fusion cell that generates a meter-long blade of coherent light. The Provost of Inks himself blessed it for me, charging it to protect our brother Eisenhorn always from the spawn of damnation. I prayed now that he hadn't been wasting his breath. I ignited the blade and fended away the next axe swing. Sparks and metal shrapnel flew from the clash, and the beast's huge strength nearly struck it from my hand. I jumped back a pace or two from the next whistling blow. My head was swimming. Was it the loss of blood or the after-effects of that seductive book? Mandragore was incandescent with fury now. I was proving to be annoyingly difficult to slay for a mere mortal. I had a dread feeling it wouldn't last. He rushed me again, towering over me, and I managed to deflect the force of the chain axe. But immediately he brought the butt of the weapon's long haft around and struck me in the chest, sending me flying. I actually left the ground and cleared several meters. I landed hard on my injured shoulder. The pain rendered me insensible for a second. That was all he needed. He crossed the blood-flecked tiles to me in two strides, the axe rising in the air as his growl rose in pitch. With a flailing motion, I kicked the necrotuke towards him. It struck the toe of one great boot.
"Don't forget what you came for, abomination!" I rasped out.
"Mandragore Carrion, son of Fulgrim, worthy of Slaanesh, champion of the Emperor's children, killer of the living, defiler of the dead, keeper of secrets." Paused. With a hacking laugh, his soulless eyes never leaving me, he stooped for the book.
"You counsel well, Inquisitor, for A."
His fingers were around the necrotuke, the metal-shod digits dwarfing it. His voice trailed away. Triumph faded from his hideous face. Rage drained away. Bloodlust dimmed. His mask of skin hung slack from its sutures. The light in his blood-rimmed eyes dulled. The necrotuke sang through every fiber and shred of corrupted being, stealing from him all sense of the outside world. I stood unsteadily, flexed my grip on the power sword, and sheared his head from his shoulders. Before it had even struck the ground, the spinning skull combusted and blazed white-hot, dripping liquid flame onto the tiles. The fireball bounced and rolled, rocked over, and consumed itself in a ferocious, dirty fire that swiftly left nothing behind but blackened shards of skull in a smouldering scorch mark. The body remained standing, burning from within the torso, shooting long tongues of sickly green flame up out of the neck cavity. A column of filthy black smoke rose into the still air. The gaudy robes and cloak quickly caught, and thick flames enfolded the headless, metal ruin. At the last moment, I struck off Mandragore's fist with the sword's bright blade, and the necrotuke it clutched fell clear of the flames. I felt as though it was pleading with me to take it up again, to immerse myself again in the wonders it contained. Such wonders. I bent down, torn by duty. The thing should be destroyed, but it held such secrets. Could not the Inquisition and the Imperium as a whole benefit from the infinite truths it contained? Had I even the right to destroy something so priceless? The Puritan part of me had no doubt, but another part abhorred the idea of wasting it. Knowledge is knowledge, surely. Evil stems from how knowledge is used, and such knowledge was here. Perhaps if I read a page or two, I could make a better decision. I shook my head to cast away the insidious thoughts. The noise of the battle came rushing back. I looked back across the plateau, beyond Mandragore's upright burning corpse and the sprawled body of Malahite. The last few pockets of fighting were playing out, and the great tiled platform was littered with dead and debris. Both carrier vehicles were ablaze. The Ceruthi had gone, taking even their corpses with them. It seemed to me the Gudrunites had overwhelmed the troopers by sheer numbers. Few figures were still standing, and I could see none of my companions. His regal cloak torn and his face bloodied, Oberon Glor strode towards me, a las pistol clenched in his right hand. "Throw that down, Glor. It's over."
"For you, yes."
He raised the weapon. A munitions canister on one of the burning carriers ignited and blew the armored vehicle apart in a stunning conflagration. Flung out by the blast, broken armor plating and sections of track whizzed through the air like missiles. A chunk of transaxle impaled Lord Glor through the back of the head. He fell without a sound.
I grabbed a piece of smoking hull plate and scooped the Necrotuke up on it. I would heed no more of its soft enticements. I let it slide off the makeshift scoop into Mandragore's upright corpse, so that it fell down through the open neck of the blazing armor into the furnace of the torso. The flames turned red, then darker still. The blaze grew more intense. Something without a mouth screamed. I limped away from the pyre. Malahite was alive and awake, calling out,
"Locke, please! Please!"
in a hoarse voice. Across the plateau, one of the naval speeders lifted into the air. Gorgone Locke was at the controls, with Datso slumped in the seat beside him. In moments, the racing speeder was disappearing over the ragged peaks, away from the plateau, towards the endless beach. Midas, Bequin, Amos, and Loink had survived the ordeal, and the battle, though all had minor injuries. 2 dozen Gudrunites were also still alive, including Yerus. Amos wanted to see to my wound, but I had bound it tight to staunch the flow of blood, and I wanted to waste no more time. "I think it would be prudent to get out of here," I told them. Fishig lay on a makeshift stretcher. The Saruthi weapon that had obliterated Twain had cost him an arm and half of his face. Mercifully, he was unconscious. 2 Gudrunites bore him up. "It pains me to say this, but we're taking him, too," I told Midas and Yerus, indicating the collapsed